Underwriting for AutoLine this week is provided by...
In this epic battle of fuel efficiency and endurance, we're here to see which hybrid has the best MPG.
That's the essence of a hybrid soul. But is there more to it?
The Hybrid Game MPG Challenge.
And now, here is your host, John McElroy.
Welcome to AutoLine This Week. We're going to be talking all about design, not just automotive design, because today we've got one of the greatest designers that's been around, a designer extraordinaire and a futurist. And I'm talking about Sid Mead. Sid, great having you on the program
today. Thank you.
Also joining us today are John Manoogian, former GM designer, also a teacher at CCS, the College for Creative Studies, and Jim Hall from 2953 Analytics, who knows a lot about design.
So thanks for having me.
Let's get started. And Sid, you know, right now there's big blockbuster movie out there called Elysium. And
yes.
I understand that reflects an awful lot of your work. How did that all come about?
Well, Neil Blomkamp, of course, was the director of District 9, which was well received. It got four Academy nominations in various categories.
Including Best Picture.
Yes. So this is really phenomenal for almost a first-time big release. Elysium is a $112 million budgeted picture. A-list, Jodie Foster, Matt Damon are the stars. And I worked with Neil at the front end of the development of the film on the action sets at the end of the big control room and some of the inner sanctum control areas. And then as the design fabrication process moved on, contributed the ground terrain look of the inside of the rotating torus. So then it went to Weta in New Zealand and other companies to do the 3D modeling. A lot of CG in this film.
You love looking into the future. That's been reflected in your automotive design, and we'll get into that. But the movie business has been good to you.
My first film was post-production Star Trek The Motion Picture, the first Star Trek with Robert Wise, the gentleman director of Hollywood, I call him. He was very quiet. He's gone now. And the second film was Blade Runner with Ridley Scott, from zero through post-production. The third one was Tron with Steve Lisberger at Disney, from pre-production to post-production. And then I think we went into 2010 and Aliens. So I got a good running start in the movie design business. And it's thrilling because it's seductive because you design something and it goes into production. You see the trailers or the finished footage and they dial in sound. So this aluminum or plywood foam core board door slams shut, and it weighs 15 tons on screen.
And sounds like it.
It's amazing. Yes, it's very, very amazing. Yeah.
With Blade Runner, is it true that you started out to do vehicles?
Yes.
And when they realized they could, because I understand at one time they wanted to shoot out on real streets, and there's one scene shot by the Bradbury Building on Broadway,
yes,
downtown L.A.
Yes.
They did that. But then after that, they were sort of condemned to the Warner's set, which is a set that it's the only one of the major studio sets that hasn't burned down. So
right,
as you walk around it, you say, Public Enemy, The Big Sleep.
Oh, you've seen it forever.
Exactly, because these sets have been around for so long.
Yeah.
And is that one of the reasons they shot it at night? Because they could hide the sets?
Well, one of the reasons they shot at night is because there's a mountain behind the lot.
Yeah, that kind of ruins
and
it.
And you don't want to see the mountain.
Right.
And plus the fact, Ridley wanted, it was a noir, I'm going to use a French word now, genre, film.
So it's noir, by the way.
But yes, right. Gosh, sacre bleu. So it was shot at night because he wanted that dark, he wanted complete control of the lighting.
And the only way you can do that, yeah.
That's right. So the film, it was in pre-production for 8 months, which is a long, long time.
Yeah.
And by the time they shopped the film, some wag in New York said the financing for Blade Runner was at least as interesting as the story.
You know, that dark, gritty look that movie has had was sort of totally against what you were doing in your previous artwork stuff.
I'm always asked that.
Was that a big deal when you started to do that in terms of how dark the movie was?
Well, no, because by the time I worked in the movie industry, by invitation, excuse me, I'd been working for corporations and for 20 years doing illustrations and design work. So the movie was just another business flowing through my corporation. I didn't really attach any particular importance to it other than that. Do your best.
Sure.
Get briefed on what you're supposed to be doing in the first place, and then go ahead and do it.
But one of the most impressive illustrations, when I was growing up looking at these things that you've done, was the illustration of the traffic jam in New York at night with the sentinels. And
in the rain.
In the rain, and it's dark. Yeah. And that, to me, had that feel of Blade Runner. And that has to be something that you did 5, 6, 7, 8 years before Blade Runner, right?
Yes. I did that in the 60s.
Whoa!
Wow.
And that rendering was what Ridley liked a lot. Because you saw there was no horizon.
Right. Yeah.
It's architecture. It's dreary. The rain is, it's horrible weather. And it's futuristic.
It did look like the future. I mean.
So he loved that rendering. But Ridley, I was the first person on staff because the vehicles had to be built. Took a long time. Gene Winfield did all the vehicles. I think about 18 or 20 of them. And so that's where we started. And because I'd been painting, I knew how to do painting very quickly with gouache. And I showed Ridley the designs that I'd come up with in situ with the background and the dreariness, and he suddenly caught on. He's an artist himself. And that's so I painted my way into the rest of the picture.
You also worked on Aliens.
Yes.
And the Sulaco, the big ship that the Marines go. But I remember the armored personnel carrier in there.
Well, here's this. I was a judge, one of 12 judges in Florida for that year's Miss America contest, picking a winner to go to Miss Universe. And we had a running back for the LA Raiders. The Raiders?
Back then, yeah.
And we had a sort of a steamy Southern novel lady writer. Her husband owned a hardware store chain. And so they wanted to spread sort of a point of view to go. So Jim Cameron, FedEx, the script down to me, stayed up all night reading it. He's a great writer. And came back on the plane sketching this Sulaco, and it was a ball. It's in one of our books. And I showed it to him. He said, no, we can't. This has to go by the camera. We don't want to pull focus. It has to be a slab kind of a thing. So that's why the shape ended up as it did. The armored vehicle, that became a 747 towing truck, because the production went to Pinewood in England very, very fast after pre-production. So that was a 747 tow truck. They took, I don't know how many tons of lead off of it, and that was the armored vehicle as the underneath part of the prop dressed.
Because it was done full size. It was just amazing to see it. And it was
full size.
It was one of those things, there's design all over it, even though when people say it's an APC, I say, look at it carefully. And they're like, oh, my God, the offset windshield, the cannon that rolled over the top.
The cannon that rolled over the top, that was my idea. And they did this all in England. I didn't go over there with the production.
Okay.
The loader, they did the pivot points with 2x2s and garbage bags stuffed with the newspapers to get it to articulate. And it was amazing. So cumbersome. Sigourney Weaver is in this thing. They had guys in black bodysuits behind running this thing. It was much too heavy. It wasn't electrified. It was manually
manipulated. It was lifted, so it was like a no puppet. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Was Geiger involved in any of that? The guy that did
the it was a 20th Century was a release. They own all the rights to it. And he wasn't involved in the second picture, but certainly in the first with Ridley Scott. And there are amusing, scary stories about working with him at Pinewood also in England.
With Giger?
Speaking of the future, I first met you in 1980 at
Detroit.
That's
not the future.
Well, I know that. But we're going to get to the future in just a second here. I met you at the Detroit Press Club. And I don't remember why you were there, but you were speaking there. And I remember going up to you afterwards and said, okay, Mr. Mead, you're a futurist. What do you see for the future of the automobile? And you said at the time, well, we're all going to be riding electronic horses running in the electronic herd. And I said, okay, elaborate, please explain what that means. And you said, it's like the old days in the saloon where the cowboy would come out of the saloon drunk, untie his horse, climb in the saddle, pass out. And the horse would go to the barn. Mm-hmm. The horse knew how to go get oats and dry hay and all that. And then you said, that's the electronic horse. And the electronic herd is just as we've seen in movies, herds of buffalo running, and they don't crash into each other. Or flocks of birds that wheel and twirl as if they're one, or school of fish doing the same thing. And you said, that's the electronic herd. So here we are from 1980. Here it is, 2013. And we're on the verge of getting the autonomous car, the electronic car that can run in the herd. My question now is, where do you see the future of the automobile going?
Well, what's worrying the auto industry right now is a younger generation coming up. They have social media at an elaborate level, and they're not particularly interested in getting their first car. They really are not. And they can go together with somebody else who has a car, but they're not really individually fascinated with the automobile as such.
It's not about the trip anymore.
Not really, no.
Because for me, it was going for a ride with my dad on the weekend. Yes. We're going to go take this car out. And he had sports cars. Mm-hmm. We'd go riding it. And then the generation after mine, it was you use the car to get to where you wanted to go, which may be the mall or whatever. And now, because of social media, there's an issue about how often do we really have to do this anyway?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And with haptic technology, touch, electronically transmitted, you can feel texture. You really don't have to be there. And they're starting to put cameras all over the world. You might be able to go to Victoria Falls and hear the sound, see the picture 24 hours a day. And that's travel without the dangers of crashing the plane or whatever. So, no, the world,
pat down, damn
the
it.
World from 10 to 15 years from now, in terms of that kind of facility, will be unrecognizable. The pyramids will still be there. So will the Washington Monument. So will the DIA, but the world as a touch and feel transportable illusion will become very elaborate.
Is it conceivable
different.
You'd have experiential centers where you can go and these places would be tied in with far more technology than you could have at home?
The new technology for a theatrical release is a dome theater, spherical projection in 3D. So you are there. You've gotten rid of the proscenium. Which is a startling thing to think about because it's completely immersive. And if you're on heavy drugs right now, it's completely immersive too. But you're in a theater, commercial theater, and you're seeing this production, theatrical release in that format at about 100 frames a second. So it's absolute reality. It's astonishing. It's going to be astonishing.
So going back, projecting 10, 15 years out, where does that leave the automobile and the automotive industry?
Well, I did a rendering years ago. It was called the 200th running of the Kentucky Derby. And I had valets in gyro pantsuits with wheels on at the ankle. Now, you could put the wheels down and lock, and then you could skate. There's a gyro right in the small of your back. And they were hand-delivering messages, which would be very elitist in a media transfer world. And so there'll be pantsuits like that, skating suits. I think there'll be a monowheel, which I've also rendered years ago for Automobile Quarterly, monowheel, gyro-balanced enclosures with a faceplate.
Those were the egg domes, right?
That's right.
Yeah, they were.
So you don't get pigeon droppings on your hair.
I hate when that happens.
Yeah. 20 miles an hour, it's 30. And so transportation will become, even now in extended architectural environments, you have speedwalks, you have lift platforms, you have escalators, and I think a lot of the transportation will be that kind of shared, almost a free public service, because over 50% of the people right now in the world live in city environments, and that's not going to go down. It's going to increase.
Is it then what you're saying is that rather than automobiles, which are still a kind of a communal transportation because they can accommodate multiple people, transportation may then become far more personalized, one unit per person.
And the freeway system or the road system might very well develop into being travel ways for automated vehicles delivering stuff and taking maybe groups of people somewhere. But I think the automobile is an individually purchased and leased or parked most of its time is kind of a fragile economic model.
And the car companies are well aware of that.
Yes, yes.
They are.
Yeah.
What do you make of Elon Musk's latest idea? It's not just his idea, obviously, this Hyperloop where you shoot people in tubes at 800 miles an hour.
The vac tube.
Yeah.
That's a dream.
Listen to this. The futurists are saying this is a dream.
First of all, it's extremely expensive.
Cheaper than a high-speed rail train
system. It's a sealed system. And how far do you want to go? You want to go hundreds, thousands of miles? I don't know.
There is an issue with this that they haven't talked about, because they always show the pod in there. You have to get in the pod where there's an atmosphere. You don't want people to, you know, because everything in the tube is evacuated of air. The reason the thing can go 800 miles an hour is there's no air friction. But you've got to get the introduce the vehicle in there. And this is all not a very simple system. You know, I mean, I like the idea. I think it's spectacular. I remember this was once in a Gene Roddenberry science fiction pilot show called Earth 2, where there was an underground thing called the sub shuttle. And it was basically a vac. But that was in the 60s, you know.
Yep.
I mean, I think it's cool. And I'm glad Elon's putting his money in it. But if he said it could be built for $6 billion from L.A. to San Francisco.
Yeah.
And when you realize that to go from Boston to put the Avela, well, the Avela, the high-speed train we do have, that goes from Boston to D.C., I think, was $17 million. And it's a lot lower
billion.
Tech.
Billion.
A billion. Billion. Sorry. These are all billions. You're right.
Yeah.
It's all super low tech by comparison.
Yeah. You know, like that politician, I forget his name right now, he said, now, once you're talking about $1 billion, we're talking about real money.
Serious
money.
Everett Dirksen.
Yes, Dirksen.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't you love it?
Yeah, billion here, billion there.
Now we're talking real money.
That thing behind you. You're familiar with this?
The Envy?
The GM Envy?
Yeah. I've seen the videos of it, yes.
What reminds me of a Sid Mead?
This is autonomous, by the way, or designed to be autonomous.
Yes. Yep.
And it uses
opens up.
It uses sort of Segway technology because it's primarily, even though it has runner wheels, it's primarily a two-wheeled vehicle.
Right.
Is this still too much of a car?
No, not really.
Okay.
No. And autonomous goes where you want it to go, which is the horse, back to the horse. And so we've come this loop aided by elaborate technology. And, of course, Google's been running their cars on public streets for, what, 3 or 4 years?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You go on the internet and you can see your house from space, or then pull the little man down, drop it on the street, and you can see your house. So that's amazing. Anywhere in the world, practically, in urban, large urban centers.
It's interesting when I do that and I see what car's in the driveway, I can figure out when the photo was taken.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yes.
Oh, I don't know when I had a red Saab.
Yeah. But this sort of thing now, these are two little windows. What you have to watch out for in automotive design is the face. And it doesn't take much. You have two spots, maybe a spot here and another spot, and it's a face. You know, eye, nose, mouth. And this has a sort of like a worried college professor expression.
Now, there were actually three of these, and they were done in different design studios, the U.S., Europe, and Australia, if I remember right. I believe this is the European design one.
Okay.
I could be wrong.
I think you're right. I think you're right. And then the red one that was more angular was the one done in Australia, I think.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And it's called the NV?
Yes.
So that means, do you envy that because you don't have one? Or?
Well, the naming of cars is interesting because you had things like the Ford Aspire, which you probably, if you owned one, you aspired to get out of
the Achieva.
The Achieva, another one.
I had a DTS after my 94 Fleetwood designed by Jordan's team. That got crashed into by an old lady in her Cadillac. So I went to a DTS and I said, what does that stand for? And they said, well, it's DeVille. We're not sure what I said is the H for chutzpah. I don't know.
There's the thing, though. Is there such a thing as the bad name for a good car? I mean, other than calling a car like monkey pus, that's probably pushing the
of course, middle. Nova is a stellar explosion of violent proportions.
Yeah.
So I don't know why you'd name a car that necessarily.
And in Spanish, it means doesn't go.
Yes, no so, va.
Yeah.
Va is the operative Latin base for Voyage, Viego, yeah.
So, but you know, the car still worked with that name. And Probe, yes. I mean, there's one. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So I'm intrigued by your outlook for the auto industry. And you're saying 10 to 15 years. That's nothing in automotive design terms. That's just a few, you know, not even a handful of design.
They're working on
it. It's two generations of a regular car.
Right.
Yeah. It's happening very, very fast. Ray Kurzweil came to our house. He was on the front end of making his movie called The Singularity. And his contention is that the speed up is speeding up. So it increases the proportion every jump. And eventually the singularity in data, graphical data depiction, is when everything goes, all the asymptotes, which are the data segments, go parallel vertical. And it goes asymptotic. And you can't graph the progress anymore. So he says that'll happen about 2035 or something like that, which is not Not that far away.
Well, I've been astonished when, in terms of autonomous technology, the great leap forward we've seen in only 6 years' time. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, and I credit
so the
DARPA
next three, challenge. We're going to see even more in the next three. We will for sure.
Well, technology, if you solve three problems, the next stage you solve seven, and then because it builds on itself, it's logarithmic. And the robot industry, humanoid anthropomorphic robots, are getting very, very accomplished. And the first target is to help old people like me go up and down stairs or carry stuff. And they'll be in medical facilities and old age or retirement, let's call them retirement, silver lodges. That's what they're, I think the guy from Honda said in 20 years we'll be making robots, not cars.
Wow. John, you teach at CCS. Are you getting into all this?
I was going to ask a real pragmatic question. What would you say then to someone who was just graduating from high school that wanted to go to college to become a car designer? What you're saying is in 15 years cars are going to be kind of gone, what does that say to somebody that wants to be, who aspires to be a car designer?
You have to learn to think.
Thank you.
Was it over 2,000 years ago? I think it was a Socrates. Because I've been asked, well, Mr. Mead, I'm spending a lot of money going to school. I said, there's no guarantee. It's
exactly.
Luck. And I said, Socrates, I think, said luck is opportunity meeting preparation. And I said, your skill set has to be competitive. And even I said, myself, I said, I always assume that somebody out there is better than I am at the same thing that I do, because there
always.
Probably is,
right.
Always.
Right.
And I treat students in these schools as my peers, because less 48 months or 36 months, they're my colleagues. And that's why we love so much to go around all these universities and do presentation, because that age bracket from 19 to about 25, that age bracket,
right.
is fascinating. They have their point of view. You can tell immediately if they've got film in the camera.
Yeah. Exactly.
I've never heard that saying before. I like that.
That's what's so much fun working with them, because they've got so much enthusiasm, so much energy.
They're not, they might be naive, but they're not cynical yet.
Right. They haven't gotten there yet.
And the success of being a survivor is being cynical. I call it being carefully crazy.
But in a way, that just says that design doesn't have to be hooked around the concept of simply a car.
No.
Automotive design is transportation design. It's mobility design.
Sid said, it's about thinking. It's the process of thinking.
Somebody said, you call it a bridge. I just call it a way of getting across the river.
There you go.
So it could be whatever.
An airplane does that, too.
That's true.
So we've talked about maybe the whole transportation system, as apropos of the automobile, is the automobile will truly fit into much more of an overall system than it does today.
Yes, I think so.
I remember back to my 1980 meeting with you. You said that we would be able to buy mobility in the future, that it would go to the extent that we would know exactly which escalator to go to. When we got to the top, the elevator doors would open for us. I mean, you thought this thing through from absolutely point A to point B, not just the car to the airport
and,
kind of a thought.
I rendered for Automobile Quarterly again back then a little picture of a scenario. There's a guy and his girlfriend looking at this scheduled map, electronic map, and here comes this round. It's a round car because all the panels are concentric circles, and you can slide things. And they're just waiting for their vehicle to arrive. It'll be programmed because they've already bought their transit time fee, paid it. And it'll just go and sit there and wait till you get there. And I think that's very definitely what the auto industry will end up doing, is creating these autonomous vehicles that are most certainly time-shared with anybody who wants them. That depends in turn on a sort of civility, respect for the fact that you're not the only one that's going to be in this.
Right.
See, that's where I don't think it'll go totally public, because I know if I use a car-sharing car, somebody's going to have spilled their milkshake inside it before I get there. And so I'm going to want my own.
Owning your own vehicle exclusive to you is becoming expensive right now. We have four cars. We have a driver, which is the DTS Cadillac. We have a 2003 Sebring convertible, lovely little car. I have a collector 72 Imperial with now 10,000 miles on it, perfect condition. And my partner Roger has a 57 Mercury two-door turnpike cruiser. Now both
the horizontal antennas.
Yes.
How cool is that?
Oh
yeah.
And
how cool
both
is that?
Cars, 2.5 tons. The Mercury has a 10-to-1 compression engine, the big Ford block. And these engines, and the Imperial has a 440, these engines move 2.5 tons very fast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But use a fair amount of fuel to do it, don't they?
Well, but then when the cars were built,
18 cents
gasoline
a gallon.
Was 18 to 30 cents a gallon, right. That whole series of years spread. So you were more worried about would it have enough gas in the tank to carry you from here to there rather than what the gas cost.
Right.
Well, real good. On that note, we're going to have to wrap this up. Sid Mead, thanks so much for coming in and sharing your visions, your remembrances past, and all that.
And it's good to see you again after all these years. Last time was just radio, right?
That's right. That's exactly right. So,
and gentlemen, you know, you're the real car people. I'm just sort of trailing along, trying to figure out what's going on and make pictures of it.
Yeah. Oh. John Manoogian, want to thank you for having come
thanks
in
for
again.
Having
Jim
me.
Hall, always great to
John,
have you
thanks.
Guys
I really
here.
Appreciate it.
This has been a terrific discussion. Hope you all enjoyed it. And please join us again next week for another episode of AutoLine This Week.
Underwriting for AutoLine This Week is provided by...
In this epic battle of fuel efficiency and endurance, we're here to see which hybrid has the best MPG.
That's the essence of a hybrid soul. But is there more to it?
The Hybrid Game MPG Challenge.